that is already reeling from years of declining social mobility and a near decade of rising child poverty. Bianca Rahimi, London.
A new wave of coronavirus has started in the Gaza Strip with over 500 new infections reported on Wednesday. During February, infections were below 100 cases daily. Coronavirus infections have reached over 60,000 cases in the blockaded Gaza Strip, mostly since late August 2020. Nearly 600 deaths have also been reported amid shortages in medicines and hospital supplies, including vaccines. The unsteady supply of medical equipment and testing kits for COVID-19 has compounded the struggle of health workers in Gaza, undermining their efforts to contain and track the spread of the coronavirus.
We are witnessing an alarming increase in the number of daily infections. Coronavirus infections' current daily rate is over 500 cases. The number of patients requiring hospitalization and medical attention is also rising at a fast pace.
COVID-19 has complicated the already dire humanitarian situation in the impoverished coastal sliver, threatening the socio-economic welfare of people in Gaza as much as their health.
We are afraid that the new coronavirus wave will result in new lockdowns that will only worsen the economic conditions. The situation is also very dangerous because of the high population density in the Gaza Strip.
The coronavirus is taking a heavy toll on us because of the blockade and the lack of resources. Things are really tough, and we are in an urgent need of medicines, hospital supplies, and vaccines.
The Israeli blockade and multiple wars since 2007 have had a devastating impact on Gaza's health sector. Local authorities in the tiny enclave have been desperately fighting to prevent the spread of COVID-19.
Since early March, infections have started to rise. The first wave of coronavirus ended during February, and at that time the curve of infections was flattened. The results were also stable and the numbers of critical cases were moderate. During March, we started to witness a rapid increase in infections and critical cases.
People here are bracing themselves for the worst as COVID-19 infections continue to increase.
The small enclave has been under a crippling blockade since 2007. Experts say the Israeli siege must be fully lifted to help avert a humanitarian disaster. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
While on a visit to Europe, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has been discussing the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, with senior EU officials.
I welcome the Secretary's reaffirmation that the U.S. is ready to engage and the prospects of a U.S. return to the JCPOA.
For his part, Blinken seemed only interested in spinning anti-Iran rhetoric following meetings at the European Commission Brussels.
We talked about our shared goal of preventing Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons.
Earlier at NATO headquarters in the Belgian capital, Blinken spoke at greater length on the subject.
To look at how we might come back to compliance with the JCPOA, we said yes, and to date Iran has chosen not to engage. So as we've said, the ball is really in their court.
Even Iran's harshest critics might find Blinken's position difficult to grasp. After all, it was the U.S. that withdrew from the agreement in 2018, at a time when Iran was in full compliance, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency. Many analysts believe Joe Biden's administration is bowing to pressure from Tel Aviv to not engage with Iran. It has been suggested, however, that Benjamin Netanyahu does not speak for everyone.
There's many parts of Israeli society and even in the authorities that believe this deal will be better for Israel in the short, medium, and even longer term.
The U.S. continues to impose illegal unilateral economic sanctions on Iran, despite the JCPOA having been underpinned by the United Nations. Tehran insists the current deal cannot be renegotiated, and the only fair and legal option for the U.S. is to rejoin the accord without preconditions. As the coordinator of the deal, legal experts say the ball is firmly in the EU's court and not Iran's. According to many analysts, Iran has demonstrated it is unwilling to remain in the JCPOA at all costs. Therefore, they say, the EU is clearly running out of time to save this landmark agreement. Jerome Hughes at the European Commission, Brussels.
As the UK races ahead with its vaccine rollout, discussions have turned to normalising large public gatherings such as sports events, cinemas and theatre shows. Britain's Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, has revealed that the government are now considering COVID passports to allow people to attend large-scale public events from June the 21st.
We'll be testing whether we can use COVID certification to help facilitate the return of sports. Obviously, final decisions have not been taken on that, and I'm working with the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, Michael Gove, who is leading on our COVID certification work programme. But I think that is a potential tool that could help the return of the things that we love.
Campaigners have been quick to push back against such proposals, adamant such a move would restrict people's right to refuse any form of vaccination. More than 300,000 people have signed a petition against COVID passports, citing MP Nadeem Zahawi, the secretary in charge of the vaccine rollout, who said there were no plans for vaccine passports back in December 2020. Last week's unease over potential blood clots being linked to the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine added more anxiety. In Brussels, the EU have announced similar proposals to facilitate freedom of movement within the bloc. Their digital green certificate would allow their 450 million residents to travel freely between nation states, one of the essential four freedoms that make up the European Union. This has become critical as a third wave of infections continues to spread. The digital green certificates will apply to tourists also. British holidaymakers who've been quick to book their European getaways are finding themselves having to get vaccines and COVID passports before travelling. Turkey, however, have come out and declared they will not be imposing such criteria, a marketing ploy designed to attract vaccine-weary holidaymakers. Concerns over vaccines and human rights will remain ongoing. Anti-vax campaigners will continue their crusade, but those in the entertainment industry, as well as countries reliant on tourism, will be desperate to get their economies back up and running. In this vein, many feel vaccine passports will ultimately become part of the new normal.
This part of the world has been on the limelight since the last few decades for its impressive growth and development. But the benefits of development are not reaching to its impoverished section. India, the world's second most populous nation and a diverse country, is still struggling to feed millions as hunger continues to be a challenging task for successive governments. For those having tough times to feed themselves, growth and development is just for a TV and a newspaper, since their lives have not changed.
This pandemic has created a humanitarian crisis in India. We saw that with the lockdown, millions of people started walking. Now, all of those people, they suddenly went from earning, 10,000, 15,000 to earning zero and having no savings to fall back on.
Based on the State of Food Security and Nutrition in the World 2020 report, there are some 189 million undernourished people in India, which accounts to about a 14% of country's overall population, which includes women and children, putting the future generation of the country at huge stake. Experts say government programs and schemes need a vigorous implementation.
It's also a challenge of A, not having enough coverage within the food security law. So like in a place like Delhi, only 37% of the population has access to rations under that food security law, whereas more than 50% of Delhi lives in slum or slum-like conditions.
India's aim to achieve the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals by 2030 includes providing nutrition to all, and ending hunger looks like a challenging task for the country, keeping in view the geography and the population. On the other hand, experts say addressing the stark food inequality and robust distribution system is the most vital way forward. Many reports, surveys, and studies suggest that India has the largest number of undernourished people in the world. However, the government has time and again junked these reports, questioning the methodology of their calculating the hunger index, saying India has made progress in feeding the most deprived
over the last decade. Experts, however, say the country needs to strengthen its delivery system and programs to achieve a lasting solution. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
The first summit between China and the United States since the election of Joe Biden produced an unexpected and extraordinary diplomatic blow-up. During opening remarks, top U.S. diplomats tried to present China as a global threat, airing a litany of complaints about the way China's government and political culture differs from the West. That breach of diplomatic norms led to an hour of public arguing, which saw China's top diplomat, Yang Jiechi, point out that the U.S. was, quote, massacring the people of other countries and, quote, toppling regimes through the use of force. Yang called the U.S. the champion of cyber attacks, noted that blacks in the U.S. are slaughtered, and asked the U.S. to, quote, stop advancing its own democracy in the rest of the world, a democracy which Yang said many Americans no longer have confidence in. The summit may come to be viewed as the beginning of a new geopolitical era defined by Chinese confidence.
A lot of the, you know, ruling class in the U.S. is very used to thinking of China as like this poor, dominated country that in recent decades has just been a source of cheap labor. And they're really frightened that this country that should have been, you know, dominated and defeated is, you know, standing up as a world power.
Just prior to the summit, Biden placed sanctions on 24 Chinese officials, which may have been designed to end any chances for cooperation even before the meeting began.
The Obama administration's pivot to Asia policy shifted the Pentagon's planning from the Muslim world to China. Biden has continued with an openly antagonistic approach, which rejects Beijing's call for cooperation amid the multiple global crises.
I just think there's so much opposition to cooperation and so much support for a new Cold War that even if Biden wanted to cooperate with China, he couldn't. Like, Trump wanted a peace deal with North Korea, a much less, like, strategic threat to the United States, and Trump wasn't able to get that through.
The talks concluded without the issuance of a final joint statement. Experts in both nations say few should expect a significant improvement in bilateral relations between the two superpowers. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
For decades now, people of Kashmir haven't witnessed any celebrations. The conflict in the region has always spoiled their joy and happiness. However, when it comes to Nowruz festival, which marks the beginning of spring, hope for a better tomorrow gives people of this war-weary region a chance to rejoice. Now people have gathered in the heart of Kashmir's capital city of Srinagar, where almond trees are blossoming to mark the arrival of spring.
People of Kashmir have nothing to rejoice, and we have faced turmoil for decades. But when we see the cycle of life in nature and how life is revived, I and many like me begin to revive too. We only hope to have a spring year round, since we have missed it for decades.
Youngsters are busy clicking on images and filling their social media timelines, while others are enjoying the beauty of fresh blooms. And to add to this glory, Kashmir's administration has organized a concert.
Spring will soon begin, and we want it to start on a happy note. We want people of Kashmir to be full of hope, energy, and enthusiasm, so that this energy boosts their morale throughout the year.
Nowruz, a Persian tradition of welcoming spring, became part of the culture of Kashmir after Persian scholars and saints came to Kashmir and preached Islamic teachings centuries ago. Since then, Kashmir and Persia have shared many similarities, including food. Here at the Little Persia, friends and families have gathered in Kashmir's only Persian food-serving restaurant to celebrate the occasion of Nowruz. The owner says the practice aims to retain the fantastic culture of Persia through food.
I came back to Kashmir like 7 years before. I noticed I was always intrigued by the cultural similarities we have with the Persian community or per se, like the Iranian community or with Iran. So I noticed those similarities, and I dwelled in the history and in the books of, like, you know, of a tradition, and that I got to know, like, you know, we were one of the tribes that actually came from there, and then we settled here. So our culture is, like, majorly influenced and pretty much originates from that part of the world.
Picturesque Kashmir, known as the Venice of East, attracts tourists from around the globe. However, decades of turmoil and now the COVID-19 pandemic have pushed the region's economy to its ever lowest. Nowruz symbolizes hope, revival, and life. People of Kashmir say no one other than those suffering in this world would realize the importance of a new beginning, and they only hope to see their spring season last long. Shahana Butt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
The 6th of Shaban is the title of the latest retaliatory attack carried out by the Yemeni army against one of Aramco oil sites in the Saudi capital Riyadh using drones. The Yemeni army says the operation comes in response to the Saudi continued deadly aggression.
The Yemeni army will continue its strategic operations deep inside Saudi Arabia until the sources of oil dry up. And Aramco, the source of Saudi economy, is destroyed. We will force the Saudi enemy to realize the reality of our capabilities. These operations will continue until the war is stopped and the blockade imposed on our country is lifted.
The Saudi regime confirmed the attack, saying it has caused a fire in the oil refinery in Riyadh and it was controlled. Observers say the Yemeni army should continue such attacks to deal heavier damage to the Saudi economy.
These operations will not have an impact unless the oil facilities are continuously attacked. The oil is the lifeline of the Saudi economy, and Saudi Arabia is using oil money to buy mercenaries and weapons. So these operations must not stop.
For 6 years now, Yemenis have been under a devastating war imposed by Saudi Arabia and its allies that caused the death of tens of thousands of people. Many of them are women and children. Riyadh has also forced an all-out blockade on Yemen, which has caused more deaths than weapons had.
Yemenis say the army has the right to continue targeting Saudi facilities until Riyadh stops its years-long war and siege against them and releases the illegally detained oil ships. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of halim, please.
Hi, sir.
Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger, to let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. O the Most Merciful.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. U.S. President Joe Biden has addressed Americans after a surge in attacks against Asians inside of the United States. Now, he said that the U.S. is no place for hate. And that sounds like a great slogan, but if we look at the historic reality, it seems that hatred has been a consistent fiber of life for many minorities in the country.
The United States has witnessed yet another hate crime against minority groups that sparked a nationwide debate over the threats these people are facing in the country. On Wednesday, a white man gunned down 8 people, including 6 Asian women at spas around Atlanta. The incident raised fears that it might be a new wave of attacks on Asian Americans. A report released by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence said racially motivated extremists pose the most lethal domestic terrorism threats to the U.S. It also warned that threats from domestic violent extremism are metastasizing across the country and could grow in 2021. Hate crimes against minorities in the U.S. have significantly increased over the past years, as former President Donald Trump explicitly favored white people over people of color. Many African Americans and Hispanics have been attacked or killed by white police officers or extremist groups. Asian Americans are in no better condition. They have been grappling with a rise in hate crimes since the coronavirus outbreak, as Trump directly blamed China for the pandemic. Now the question is, how would a country whose foundation has been built on killing the minorities manage to get rid of racism, which has been entrenched in its culture for centuries?
I'd like to welcome my guest to the program out of Washington, D.C., senior member of Black Alliance for Peace, Netva Freeman, and professor at CUNY and political commentator, Danny Shum, out of New York. Welcome, both of you, to the program. Let's start this off in D.C. with Netva. What do you think is actually behind the spike in attacks that we're witnessing right now against Asians?
Well, I think most people understand that it started with a lot of the rhetoric that Donald Trump was having, and people in that of that ilk in terms of the United States, like low level of xenophobic, more the low level of political understanding and analysis, but highly xenophobic dispositions and mentality, and trying to blame, and the U.S. not really taking responsibility on, you know, for its role and the spread and proliferation of the pandemic here. And then, you know, Trump making his comments, and then people and other people, not just Trump, but other people, Kung Flu and all those kind of crazy things. But at the same time, we should not make this only about Trump, because I think here the Democrats, the Democratic Party, particularly this new administration, would love to scapegoat Trump and his role in that Trump administration, and the rise of xenophobic and right-wing racist phenomenon, or not really a rise in it. It's not really more prominent than it was before, but maybe it's gotten more desperate. But we also shouldn't divorce it from the foreign policy and the angling of the United States, which is very racist foreign policy disposition toward China and Korea, and angling for war, and that in itself comes with its own propaganda. You know, Washington, the Wall Street Journal, and all of them participate in this angling. So when people have low levels of political understanding, and they don't understand colonialism and how the global economy works and things like that, then they will often see as their adversaries people that are not like them, and the people who are in the eye in this kind of focus, this lens of attack. And so that's where I would start with that, is that, you know, it's generally the United States capitalist, settler, colonialist system and imperialist government that kind of sets this tone and is an incubator mm-hmm. for such backwards ideas.
Okay. Well, Danny, touching on some of the same points that Netva has made, so I want your perspective on how much of what we are witnessing do you think relates to what we saw take place during the Trump administration. As Netva said, it was as far as the jargon that was used and the whole atmosphere, is it more that, or in general, that this country basically was built on racism, and there is a great racial divide that is taking place in the U.S. now?
In the words of Malcolm X, you can't have capitalism without racism. And we are fed a steady diet of xenophobic, anti-immigrant, xenophobic miseducation in this country. Unfortunately, these horrific killings in Atlanta do not come as a surprise in a country where, in the words of H. Rap Brown, racism is American as apple pie. After January 6th, with the countdown to inauguration, we were just counting how many incidents, how many high-profile incidents of anti-Asian violence would there be. And as Netva has laid out in his summation, there's this long history of anti-China, anti-socialist propaganda. We only have to check the front page every day of the Financial Times in London, in the New York Times here, and across this country. So it's not just coming from the right wing. It's coming from both wings of the ruling class. As the competition with China heats up, this is a technological and economic and diplomatic battle. So these headlines, unfortunately, are going to continue to play out, especially among the white working class, who's been fed how many centuries of white supremacy and in backwardness.
Well, Netfer, what do you make of Biden's comments that the U.S. is not a country of hate? Because if we look at the U.S.'s terrible record when it comes to dealing, especially with Native and Black Americans, it's deeply rooted in hate. But your overall take on the way this administration has been addressing this issue, do you see it as being hypocritical?
Well, it's absolutely hypocritical, and what it comes at a time where actually this this wing of the ruling class, which is dominated by the Democratic Party and this Biden-Harris presidency, is really doing its best to, this issue emerges when it's doing its best to play on a crude identity politics that's absent of the class struggles, that's absent of capitalism, and trying to play on, well, Black Lives Matter and other people matter, and that movement that's making them have to address what's being called racial injustice or racial justice has emerged, particularly young people who have a very internationalist purview, who are open to other peoples, and they're trying to but they want that to stay there, and they don't want like what we just what we talked about here earlier with Danny mentioning. Is that the United States and its capitalism is intertwined with racism, and they can't be separated. They need to separate it, and so that's what they're doing. So he has to give pronouncements, denouncing what's happening. They want to make sure we don't make the connections of those things with the foreign policy toward like North Korea and China and other places around the world. It's absolutely hypocritical. Not to mention, even if we're talking about police, they have to embrace police in spite of the fact that the overwhelming sentiment against the racial justice against the police and how racist they are as an institution. And so, you know, it's nothing but hypocrisy when he can't tease out all the rest of the interconnections and intersections of this issue.
Well, Danny, in 2020, we saw many people protest against racial inequality. What came about with those demonstrations? Has anything changed?
That's a great question. A lot of window dressing, especially from the Democrats, but institutionally, systematically, what has changed? Segregation and white supremacy and police brutality has not changed. A year ago, when Breonna Taylor was murdered, we're coming up on the one-year anniversary of the brutal torture and assassination of George Floyd. But the people continue to resist, proving how true the statement is that repression breeds resistance, and only resistance can bring us our freedom. Today, across the country, as we speak, there are demonstrations against racism, against anti-Asian hatred and hate crimes. So really, it's only the people in motion with these different anti-racist and anti-imperialist organizations who can usher in a new day. It's not going to be a Joe Biden or a Kamala Harris or any other white knight from their pedestal that's going to cause any real systematic change. So I think it's correct to be in the streets, to stand with our Asian sisters and brothers across this country at this crucial moment, at this tragic historical moment.
Well, Nefta, listen to what Danny just said. Let's talk about that possibility, talking about a rising resistance. When we look at, because you pointed out and talked about the way the U.S. is handling its foreign policy and the way it has demonized, for example, China or North Korea, and, of course, the way the media, the mainstream media, also promotes what the state is basically telling them. So how likely is it that we will get to that point of this rising resistance, this, if you want to say, woke group that really can make that change that's necessary?
It's interesting that you use the term woke, because the Wall Street Journal rather just had put out a thing using the term sort of more disparagingly, mm-hmm. as the way of disparaging the xenophobia and racism and whatnot. But I think one of the things, and this is where the media is very key to the answering into your question, is that it is quite likely. One of the things, in spite of all of the megaphone, you know, they're using to put out their propaganda and their spin, is that they're not reporting on, for example, Danny mentioned a lot of the demonstrations that are going on. If we go into those demonstrations, particularly if you look at people's journalism and people's coverage, so to speak, that the internet has on social media and whatnot, we can see a lot of solidarity with these young people across race lines, quote unquote race lines, if you will, but also recognizing the solutions that Danny talked about, that it's not within the state, and then denouncing the police. I saw one, a young woman, Asian woman, who was talking about having a discussion with her mother about the role of the police, and them thinking, well, the hate crimes that are emerging against Asians in the United States means that we have to embrace the police. And she was explaining to her mother, no, the police don't keep us safe. And then she talked about the racist policies and actions and implementation of police against African people, black people in this country. And so, and you know, just if you look, if you're on the ground among the people, you can see that there's an emerging young generation that sees through this stuff. We just don't get, it doesn't get reported. As long as we're also using mobilizations to engage in organization with political education, then it's inevitable. This system is crumbling, and the contradiction of the system cannot be hidden. I mean, they can do a good job of making it look like it's hidden, but it's not really hidden from the people who have to face the consequences of it.
Well, Danny, in a report released by the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, it says the biggest threat to the United States is racially motivated domestic terrorism. Your take on this assessment?
Yeah, no question. I mean, even the FBI in the state has recognized this, yet here we have this assassin, this racist murderer, killed 8 people, and the police apprehend him peacefully. He doesn't have a scratch on him. So we see whether it's Dylan Roof or this other young man, these are deeply sick individuals, infected with how many decades and centuries of the white supremacy, and then the police handle them with kids' gloves. I think it's important to continue to take these big steps back and contextualize internationally how fearful this decaying empire is of China, of China's $1 trillion investment in other countries across Latin America, the new accords with Australia, with Japan, with other Asian powers. We remember Obama's pivot to Asia, so quote-unquote away from the war on terrorism. So it's within this context that we see these attacks on China, as if China were somehow our existential threat here in New York City and D.C. and beyond, when it's probably the coronavirus, lack of health care. But you cannot have war without racist demonization of the quote-unquote enemy. So that's the context that really puts whether somebody is Southeast Asian or Vietnamese or Filipino, they fall into this category of a people who's being branded as this internal enemy. So if we don't have that context, then we're going to believe the MSNBC and CNN headlines that these are just individual racist attacks, when in fact it's part of something much bigger.
What about that, NETFA, what Danny just said about that demonization? And he was talking, of course, on an international level, but even locally. I mean, if we look at what's happening inside the states, there are some analysts who talks about that this technique that is being used is the divide and conquer, divide the people, divide them into races, divide them into whatever you can divide them into, in order that they cannot unite and actually really make a change in the system. What do you think about that side of things?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's absolutely true. You can't have it without having even domestic, propaganda to confuse people. In fact, I alluded a couple of times to this Washington Wall Street Journal article that talked about what it was doing was demonizing language and accusing China and a media thing of using woke language, as it said, to confuse create racial tensions in the United States and animosity, as if there's not racism here already. And a way of saying that social justice movements are being influenced by outside agitators is that whole trope that's longstanding in the United States. Just like they did the same thing with Russia, and saying these little insignificant social media posts were aggravating tensions in the United States, as opposed to the actual real root problem itself being the cause of the unrest here. And so what is that? That's to divide us, to create, to some attempt, and I will say it's a feeble attempt. It's not going to, it can't, I don't think it will work, but a feeble attempt to accuse those of us who are on the ground talking about racial justice of being influenced by something else and not having the intelligence to know the difference between what really ails us and afflicts us as opposed to, you know, these other messages, so-called messages that are supposed to be coming from somewhere else.
Well, Danny, your take, how do you see the future in the United States? Because you talked about these growing movements and these demonstrations and more young people having more of an international perspective. Do you see the future, basically, the pendulum swinging as far as the amount of people who are aware and being able to make a change in that system? Or do you see the system just crumbling, basically, because it won't make the changes that these young people and others are demanding?
Yeah, a study showed that 43% of young people in the U.S. look favorably upon socialism. I think there's more and more international solidarity every day with different struggles in the global south, whether it's in Haiti or in Nicaragua and Cuba and Venezuela. One-third to one-fourth of humanity lives under the suffocating sanctions of the empire. So it is upon us for the pendulum to swing. It won't be delivered by UPS or from on high, from without. It is incumbent upon us to organize this movement through popular education, to oppose it every moment, ruling class ideology, all of the ugliness and backwardness and white supremacy that seeps through this miseducational system, this mainstream corporate media. So there's a lot of work in front of us, and how important for everyone out there to join an organization, join study groups, and to be a part of this history, because all of humanity and the future of the planet depends upon it.
Nat, for your take, what do you think it's going to take to bring about the necessary change in that country?
You mean in the U.S.?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with exactly what Danny said, and I think it's that the most impacted, the most people that facing the most disparaging impacts of this system, unjust capitalist racist system, need to be organized, and the particularly working class people of non-white working class need to be at the lead of that struggle, making unity with the broader working class in the United States. And then we also, I'll just say this, is we also have to, they're doing their best in the previous example that we mentioned, doing their best to disparage other forms of media information, because they're not, it's a desperate attempt, because they know people are realizing they can't depend on these corporate forms of information, so they want to disparage other folks. So, you know, like we mentioned, the Wall Street Journal's attempt. So we have to be able to look at other outlets like this one, like the media outlet right here. None of these corporate things will have Danny or I on here or anybody else talking about this topic the way we're talking about it. And so we have to look for other forms of information. And like Danny said, we also have to engage in collective popular education, political education, not just consuming the information, but getting together so we can have an interpretation of the information that we're getting to inform our organizing.
Thank you both for being with us on this debate. Senior member of Black Alliance for Peace, Netfa Freeman out of Washington, D.C., and Professor Ed Cooney and political commentator Danny Shaw, New York. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Noru's special. The message of spring is to tell human beings that he's not less than nature. As nature awakens, we humans, too, should wake up from negligence and abandon grudges and deep-rooted complexes to purify our souls. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said, "He who does not become aware from the change of the world is among the most negligent people." Spring is a valuable means to lead humans towards cognizance of God and worship of God. Spring is a manifestation of God's power. The spirit of spring is the spirit of monotheism, contemplation and refreshment. Spring teaches the lesson of completion and perfection. Spring is a product of a creator who revives nature with his infinite power. Spring is a great sign of God to attract our attention to the world, which is developing every moment. Spring and the Nowruz convey the message of rebirth for mankind, and nature is a small picture of resurrection, which is shown to mankind every year. There are myriads of signs of resurrection in nature. There are many verses in the Noble Quran which point to this reality. For example, verse 9 of Surah Fatir, for instance, reads, "And it is Allah who sends the winds, and they raise a cloud. Then we drive it towards a dead land, and with it revive the earth after its death. Likewise will be the resurrection." The verses which point to the revival of nature refer to its thriving in spring after the cold winter. But the depth of these verses indicates that God tries to awaken us and make us heedful of our fate. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, "Whenever you see spring, remember the resurrection and your death a lot." Spring changes nature and opens the eyes of trees and flowers towards light and warmth. We too should try to clean our soul to get warmth of love and affection, to sympathize with fellow human beings and be thoughtful of their pains and sufferings. spring gives us the opportunity to learn from nature. Generosity, affection, kindness, and altruism are the lessons that can be acquired from nature. As a matter of fact, generosity is among the characteristics that prevail in spring. Everyone tries to share its happiness with others. It is narrated that once, during the Eid al-Fitr, or the Feast of Fasting, Muslim women donated their bracelets and earrings to the Prophet of Islam to be spent for the poor and the destitute. The Almighty says in verse 7 of Surah Ibrahim in the Holy Quran, "And when your Lord proclaimed, 'If you are grateful, I will surely enhance you in blessings.'" Moreover, the Holy Quran stresses that the faithful should donate what they like in order to reach goodness. Verse 92 of Surah Al-Imran reads, "You will never attain piety until you spend out of what you hold dear." The message of spring for mankind is to know that human being is no less than nature, so it is a matter of shame to be negligent of the divine bounties and spend a life in ignorance and heedlessness. We can make every day Nowruz, a new day, through generosity, visiting relatives and being kind to others. The first infallible successor of the Prophet of Islam, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, says, "Any day on which God is not disobeyed is Eid or feast." This shows that what matters is to keep aloof from sin and to obey God Almighty. Every sin makes us distant from our innate nature and divine essence. Spring is the loveliest of seasons. But the real spring of hearts and souls will come when the Savior of mankind, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, reappears from behind the curtain of occultation. That is why he is called Rabi'ul Anam, or the spring of all the peoples. There are many narrations which recommend the faithful to be mindful and in remembrance of Imam Mahdi in Nowruz. Spring is a revival of nature, whilst Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, is the spring of the entire creation. Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, says, "There is no Nowruz except we, the progeny of the Prophet, wait for the reappearance of Imam Mahdi on it, because Nowruz is among our days and the days of our Shias." In another narration, Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, says, "Nowruz is the day on which the Qa'im of us, the Ahlul Bayt, will reappear." Spring has come to insert love and affection in hearts and empty them from grudges and hostilities. It has come to clothe the hearts and souls with new garments. It has come to adorn hearts with godly merits. Spring is the season of renewal, of regeneration, revision, and refreshment. It is a good chance to rethink, to reset, to replan, to rearrange, and to restore.
Good morning.
Good morning.
heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is...